This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Here we are, the last show of 2015. A lot of news organizations are doing their year in review programs. And looking at these programs, looking at these articles, what strikes me is how little understanding these news organs give. They talk about these are the things that happen. They say these are the things that people were most interested in. Some of them even say, here are the ways that the world got better in 2015. Well, today we want to look at the important events of this past year, but this is not a year in review program. It is not. We are not really interested in just listing what happened. We're not going to give you a list of events that occurred in these various regions. We want to talk about how the events of 2015 changed the world. This world is changing rapidly. And at the Trumpet, we talk about how world events are moving the world forward in terms of the fulfillment of biblical prophecies. And really, it's only when you look at events in these terms that you realize just how important the changes that happened in the world over this past year really are. So on the program today and the program next Wednesday, we're going to look at the world region by region. And we're going to ask and answer and discuss two big questions. The first is, what was the biggest change within this region over the past year? And, you know, we're really talking about how did this region change the world? What happened in this region that really changed the world in 2015? And then we're going to conclude our look at each of these regions by projecting forward and answering the question, what is the biggest change that we should watch for in this coming year? So we have brought together our dream team of analysts and individuals to talk about these things. We have a record number of our writing staff in the studio here. It's very cozy and it's nice with all of these bodies in here. We've got Brent Noctegal.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
We've got Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Anthony Chibadirwe.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
So at the end of the program, just for good measure, we're actually going to bring in an additional individual, our social media manager, David Vigil, to give a bit of how the work changed in 2015, reporting on the developments over this past year in this radio program, the work of the Philadelphia Church of God. So we have a special guest waiting for at the end of the program. So on the program this week, we're going to focus on two regions, the Middle East and Europe. Next week, we'll talk about Asia and Anglo-America. But the first region that we're going to look at is the Middle East. And I'm going to give Brent 8 minutes or so to answer the question, what was the biggest change within this region over the past year?
All right. Well, it was no secret that from the start of the presidency of Mr. Barack Obama here in the United States, that he has sought to withdraw from the region of the Middle East and withdraw from the traditional role of the United States inside the Middle East, the traditional policing role. And 2015 marks the year that that strategy really did become a reality. In the Middle East, enemies no longer fear what America might do, and allies fear what they'll do in the absence of America. And the fact now stands that both enemies and former allies no longer include America in their decision-making in the Middle East. And the key to this withdrawal of America was the ending of hostilities with Iran, and specifically as evidenced through the nuclear deal that was made this year between Iran and world powers. So that was the greatest evidence of this change. And there are a lot of knock-on effects that took place both with enemies and allies in the Middle East of the United States because of how they saw that the United States was acting in this nuclear deal.
So you're viewing the nuclear deal as evidence that this is the natural outgrowth and the most important result of America's determination to pull out of the Middle East.
Right.
So we see that that deal happen, and then we see what happened as a result of that deal.
Exactly. Thanks for clarifying my introductory statements. Now, I've got a few points here of proof that America no longer takes part in the decision-making of these countries. And the first one I'd like to cover is what Iran has been doing in the lead-up to the nuclear negotiations that were concluded in July this year or June this year, and then after the fact as well. It's no surprise or it was very obvious to the world that the United States was hungrier for this deal to take place. They have given up a lot of negotiating capital on the way to making this deal take place. And Iran has received a virtual free pass this past year to do what it likes in the region because America wanted this nuclear deal. Now, if we look at what Iran has done in Iraq, first of all, we can see that they've increased their presence there through the Iraqi or the Shiite militias inside Iraq. We have the Islamic State inside Iraq and Syria. And while the world focuses on the actions of the Islamic State, really they are a sideshow, if we can call them that, to what is taking place in the other nations, especially Iran. And inside Iraq, we had the increase, like I said, of this support for the Shiite militias. They were the most effective ground forces inside Iraq at pushing back the Islamic State. And even though Prime Minister Abadi of Iraq tries the best he can to stop Iran from taking over his country, what we've seen now that the power players on the ground, they answer to Iran, not his government. And we'll expect that to continue in the future, of course. Then in Syria, for the past couple of years, since the Syrian civil war has been going on, we know that President Bashar Assad, he is a proxy, basically, of Iran. He was supported, propped up by Iran. But Iran didn't have troops on the ground inside Syria. They left that fight to the Syrian army, left that fight to Hezbollah. But in 2015, we saw Iran be bold enough to actually send ground forces, Iranian soldiers with Iranian uniforms into another country, into Syria, to try and prop up Assad. This is something that they would not have done before. This is something that the United States would have protested against and probably would be effective at making sure that they didn't go in there. But Iran no longer fears retribution of the United States, so they could do that. Then also at the start of 2015, you had Iran mobilizing its other proxy inside Yemen. The Houthis out there, a Shiite group, they took over the capital city of Sana'a in early January and virtually started or continued a civil war there inside that country in an effort to gain control of the sea gateway, the passage of the Red Sea from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. There's a really critical strait there that's just 20 miles wide with a couple of islands that goes to the Horn of Africa to Yemen. And Iran mobilized the Houthis, gave them weapons, and they, as soon as they conquered the capital, they were shouting, "Death to America, death to Israel." Now, the government inside Yemen, they were American-friendly. They were supported by the United States, but the United States wouldn't do much, again, to keep their ally in power, and right now there's a toss-up for who's going to be in control of Yemen. So that's what Iran was doing. They felt totally able to proceed with their foreign policy objectives, with the expansion of their Neo-Persian empire, without fear of the United States doing something. Now, what about the allies of the United States, or the former allies, we could call them? In 2015, we saw, if anyone doubted that the United States withdrawing, just look at what United States allies are doing. Their decision-making is now not based on what the United States is going to protect or provide for them in ways of protection. The biggest player here is Saudi Arabia, former ally of the United States. U.S. used to provide a lot of material for them. But right now you've got the Saudis that started out in March of this year. They formed a 10 or 12 nation alliance to go and fight in Yemen, to fight against what the Iranians were doing. This is the first time that you had an actual nation fight. Saudi Arabia using its force as its military fighting against an Iranian proxy. That was taking place, and then that wasn't that successful of an alliance. So what they did is, what we've seen recently, is they're cobbled together another type of Islamic alliance to try and withstand Iran's march across the Middle East. Then
a response
to the fact that this nuclear deal is going on and the US refuses to do anything to counter Iran. So these allies have to then provide the protection themselves. They are looking to themselves and they are looking to other people as well. If we just turn to Israel, we've seen 2015 really heighten the tension between the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Obama administration. He came in March to speak before the United States Congress in an effort to show the real facts on the ground about this nuclear deal. If you think the nuclear deal stopped Iran from getting a nuclear bomb, look at the enemies of Iran. What do all of the enemies think? What does Saudi Arabia think? They're scrambling to have a nuclear program or get nukes from Pakistan. The Israeli prime minister came there 2 weeks before his election, and the Israelis voted him back in. Huge swing to the right in Israel because the Israeli public doesn't believe that the nuclear program is going to be stopped through this nuclear deal. The Israelis believe they're going to have a strong man in power to ensure that Iran doesn't attack them. So you could say that the reason Netanyahu's in power again is because of the nuclear deal. You could argue that case. So I think I've taken my time. I could probably speak for longer, but some stuff could come up in discussion, I guess.
Well, it is interesting. You know, I just looking at some of the lists of some other analysts out there, a lot of them say the biggest change in the Middle East was the rise of the Islamic State. And that certainly is what has gotten the headlines. But if anything, it actually paved the way for this nuclear deal with Iran. You got the Islamic State looking like the bad guys. I mean, they're the ones that are chopping heads off and doing a lot of things that would get a lot of attention. Iran comes across looking like the moderate. They look like the potential ally by comparison. They actually present themselves as a potential ally in the fight against the Islamic State. And then a lot of people also looking at the nuclear deal with Iran as the big success story in the Middle East for 2015. You know, this is the triumph of diplomacy over war, that type of thing. So it is interesting to look at it from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, because we've been talking about it since early 1990s, 93, 94, that Iran was going to rise up and basically become the premier power in the region. And we saw a massive lurch forward for Iran in that effort in 2015.
Yeah, really, looking at the Islamic State, you can see that they have provided the greatest justification for action inside the Middle East of powers that wanted to increase their influence. If you say you're going to fight against the Islamic State, you get world public opinion. What rescued Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, from dismal public opinion outside his country? It was the fact that he says, I'm going to go into Syria and claim that I'm fighting against the Islamic State. Then you have the Paris attacks that happened soon after that. Now the world is like, hey, Russia's doing a good job. Let's get in with Russia. Now Putin's a wonderful guy. It looks like that from Iran as well. Who's the lesser of two evils? Is the Islamic State worse than Iran? Probably with some of their actions. But you talk to some people on the ground that have seen how these Shiite militias work in Iraq, or even the Syrian dictator Bashar Assad and what he's done, and they'll say they've done what the Islamic State's done and worse, burning people alive, beheading people. They've done it as well. That's the truth of the matter. But in 2015, no one looks at Iran as a pariah anymore on the world scene. They are a fully fledged member of peace negotiations as well. Inside Syria, they came to the table for the first time with world powers to talk about peace, like they want to provide peace in Syria when they're the reason, as they propped up Assad, for the creation of the Islamic State. If Iran wanted an excuse to get into the fight, they got it through the Islamic State.
Yeah, you could almost make a case that the worst thing that happened in the Middle East is the Islamic State. The worst thing that happened in the Middle East is the Islamic State, in the sense that it made the world ignore Iran. Everyone knows that Iran is a terrorist sponsoring nation. The U.S. intelligence community knows that. And in fact, in February, there was one report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. This is the umbrella body that comprises all the intelligence community in the United States, the FBI, the CIA, and whatnot. And they came up with a report accusing Iran of sponsoring terrorism. However, because of the Islamic State, they actually praised Iran at the same time. They praised Iran for fighting against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. So because of the Islamic State, Iran now looks like a savior.
You know, what the other interesting thing that strikes me, you were talking about framing this whole discussion in the sense of it was America pulling out of the Middle East that paved the way for this. And it was America's determination to get out that led to them just being so determined against whatever, you know, at whatever cost to make this deal with Iran. We talked about this right back at the beginning of the Gulf War, you know, after 9/11, when America went after Iraq. That was our first, well, we went after Afghanistan, and in 2003, we went after Iraq. This was the number one adversary against Iran at the time. It was really the one power in the region, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, that could have checked Iran and that really kind of maintained a balance of power within the Middle East, and America took him out. And that it was America that really paved the way for Iran's rise, even back to 2003. What we're seeing now is the ripple effects from that. We're seeing the natural flow of events that have come from that, and it's just remarkable to see how much it's been the United States that's been driving this process from the very beginning.
Yeah, I remember at the time that in 2003, when they started to U.S. troops started to remove Saddam Hussein, we even talked a lot about how it's not going to work, you know, going after Saddam when you've still got the head of the terrorist snake there in Iran. I remember we had pictures and graphics of that Iran was obviously the chief backer of terrorism throughout the world. If you want to respond after 9/11, it would have been to really increase pressure on Iran. But yeah, removing the power that checked them wasn't the best idea. And in that void is where you've had the Islamic State grow.
And the other thing is the headlines that we put in at that time. We had on the cover story of our issue in 2003, the statue of Saddam Hussein falling. The headline is Iraq about to fall to Iran? Gerald Flory wrote this article, and it was based on forecasts that he had been making for several years, based on Psalm 83 and the prophecies of the Bible that said that Iran was actually going to take control of Iraq. Now, the headlines that you're giving us now, what happened in 2015, this is reality. Iraq is essentially, they are beholden to Iran in a way they've never been to this point, in spite of the efforts of the prime minister to prevent it. But right. Iran is entrenched there now.
Yeah, Iraq has become a vassal of Iran through this past year. I think it's interesting as well, just to look at the rationale behind Mr. Flory writing that article and saying that there were some other geopolitical strategists that are like, hey, removing Saddam is a bad idea. Mm. Iran is going to get control. They are a majority Shiite nation. Iraq is. So we can see that this might happen. But that wasn't the rationale behind Mr. Flory's decision to talk about how Iraq would fall. It was based off a text 2,500 years old. And he said, no, as looking into those prophecies of this king of the south, inside being the Iranian leader of that, we can tell that Iraq's going to fall.
So framing all of this discussion in the context of America withdrawing from the Middle East, we haven't even talked about another just phenomenal development in the Middle East as a result of America pulling back, and that is Russia just coming right in and putting themselves in the middle of the situation.
Yeah, we saw Russia return to the Middle East, something that hasn't happened since the end of the Cold War, and they are fully entrenched in Syria, propping up the Syrian regime. And all of this is happening because they knew there would be no repercussions from the Americans. In fact, I think the American administration is happy. They've even said as much in the last couple of months that the Russians are there taking care of the Islamic State. We can work together to have a transitional government to maybe sometime remove Assad. But we've got Middle East decisions now from nations, whether they're going to act or not. They're putting Russia right into their focus of how Russia will respond to their actions, not the United States. And that might be something we could see in the future as well, going forward, whether Russia does play a bigger part in the Middle East. That has been traditionally places where they have faced off with the United States through the 60s and 70s through different regional allies in the region.
I had a quick question while we're on the topic of Russia, just how it might relate to Egypt and the trends that we're expecting to unfold there in Egypt. We've long talked about the Bible prophecy saying that sometime very soon, the united European power, the King of the North, will enter into the Middle East, and it will destroy the Iran-led axis, called in the prophecy the King of the South. And the prophecies say that when Europe embarks upon that destruction, it will also destroy Egypt. Egypt shall not escape, I think it says. And we've said that that's because at that future time, Egypt will be an ally of Iran. And so right now, though, we see Sunni Egypt and Shia Iran still quite hostile toward each other. But both are increasingly friendly toward Russia. And so Russian presence in such a significant capacity, it's kind of a new development there in the Middle East, and it is having an influence on all kinds of trends and foreign policy patterns. And so my question is just, do you think that the reason Egypt will be targeted by the European superpower could have less to do with it being directly allied with Iran and maybe more to do with Egypt being allied with Russia?
I think that while the move away from the United States could initially be replaced by Russia backing Egypt, because obviously Russia was in Egypt, the Soviet Union was in Egypt helping them out before the Americans were there, and then basically they ousted that with Sadat, when he came into power, the Americans replaced the Russians as being the chief financial aid giver to Egypt, chief military hardware giver as well. So we could see that Russia will probably try to move in there in the absence and vacuum created by the United States. Again, with America's withdrawal, we haven't even touched on how they've treated their Egyptian ally in the past year as well. But I tend to believe that it won't be the European counterattack on Egypt, well, the attack onto Egypt won't be because of Russian influence in the region inside Egypt, though that might have led to Egypt getting in bed with Iran, possibly mediated through Russia. But I think what we see in Iran, just looking forward to the future, there's more prophecies that really showcase what their strategy is going to be as we look forward even into next year. This is something that we can be watching for and something that we could expect to take place in the next year, is that they'll increase their power and presence through the Red Sea area all the way through North Africa and the southern Mediterranean.
You know, I just before we go on about what to expect in the future, a year ago, I don't even think Russia would have factored into the calculus of what we would expect to see in the Middle East. I mean, it has added a dimension of difficulty or complexity to this situation. And it's interesting because we talk so much about how much Europe is invested in the Middle East, how much they're the power to really watch in terms of how they're going to change the face of the Middle East in the future. How much does Russia's entrance into that theater increase the ambition or the need for Europe to intervene? It's just very interesting.
Yeah, I think they would be a little bit more concerned than they're letting on at the moment of Russia's moves into Syria and potentially helping out Egypt and such. They have to realize that if Russia gets in control of Egypt and even through Syria, and they're helping out Iran, all that oil, they control a lot of the oil in the world there, and they could influence that, something that Europe doesn't have much of themselves and that they will need.
So quickly, the biggest change, based on what we saw, based on America withdrawing, making this deal with Iran really being set up, and I think even in some ways we're kind of seeing the effects of that deal already.
Right. I hate to be boring, but the prediction or the forecast for 2016 is that Iran increases its push through the Middle East. Iran's ascendancy continues to rise. It hasn't even got the financial relief from the nuclear deal yet. And look what it's done. We need to really think about that. 30% increase in their budget, military budget, last year, under sanctions still. So when January comes around or the start of February, they get this $100 billion, what are they going to do? They're going to export their jihadism, their terrorism, maybe bribe a couple African nations, not sure. But we expect them to do this push, not necessarily in Syria. We know that that's prophesied probably to go a different direction, but make this push for control through that Red Sea passageway, Egypt, Ethiopia, Libya, all falling under Iran's sway.
And, you know, one other thing that we haven't talked about is what happens to their nuclear program.
Yeah, that's the big thing that we haven't even discussed, but the nuclear deal paves the way for Iran to get a bomb. That's what all the enemies of Iran believe. I don't know how quickly they're going to ramp up their project once again. They've proven to be undeterred by agreements that they've made in the past. So I don't think we'll see too much change of what they've been doing for the past 10 years.
It is not difficult to foresee a real coalescing of the two camps that we've been watching develop in the Middle East. This deal, America's withdrawal, this paves the way for Iran to cement its gains, to increase its military capacity, its reach in terms of terrorist activity, and for this anti-Iranian alliance, Saudi Arabian-led alliance.
Right. If the United States did not withdraw from the region in the past year, there would be no reason for the SAM 83 alliance to exist. The United States was the backer of their countries, protecting them from Iran. Now the United States is gone. We see the coalescence of another prophesied biblical alliance, an anti-Iranian, anti-King of the South alliance.
Well, Brent is crystallizing these thoughts in an article, How the World Changed in 2015, the Middle East. You can look for that on thetrumpet.com. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to how events in Europe changed the world. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This is a special year-end program of the Trumpet Hour, How the World Changed in 2015. We've been talking about the major development in the Middle East. Now we're going to look at how events in Europe over this past year have changed the world. And for that, we'll turn to Richard in Britain. Richard, I'm going to give you 8 minutes or so to answer the question. What was the biggest change within Europe over the past year?
That was this intensified fear of terrorism and mistrust of Muslims that we're seeing in Europe. And really, there are two main drivers of this. The first is terrorism. We started the year with a terrorist attack, January 7th, the shootings at the Charlie Hebdo, and the further follow-on shootings over the next couple of days. Then in November, we had those major shootings in Paris. And this was a big deal for Europe. There's not been a major terrorist attack on European soil for about 10 years. So a lot of the urgency that was there in this fear of terrorism after 9/11 had kind of all gone away. It was still a concern, but not this major concern. Now you've got the deadliest attack on France in peacetime. Just two terrorist attacks in 1 year. And some of the most significant headlines that we've seen coming out of Europe have come just since that November attack. So, for example, you've got France triggering Europe's mutual defense clause after this attack, rather than looking to NATO. And Mr. Gerald Fleury, and is from the editor in the February 2016 issue of The Trumpet, talked about, he said, this will significantly alter the history of these nations and of Europe. So that was a big shift. We're seeing Europe now getting more involved in the Middle East. Like Brent talked about, they've seen that America has stepped back. This is their backyard. And so they know they're going to keep on suffering these kinds of catastrophes unless they start dealing with the problem at the source. And so they're making some very small steps towards doing that. You've got France traveling around, or the French president, Francois Hollande, traveling around Europe, speaking to European leaders, getting them to come on and get involved in Syria. You're getting Germany drawn in. They have a mandate now for close to 1,000 troops in Mali. They're in charge of training Mali's army. They're in charge of training Mali's police force. There's this build-up in Syria now. They're getting involved in Syria. They're stepping up their mission to train the Kurds in Iraq. Just over this weekend, they agreed to take part in a NATO mission monitoring Turkey's airspace. So you just see them now getting much more, or just starting to get pulled into that region. Then there's the more subtle response of just this rise in fear that is more significant but harder to measure. And so, for example, you had Peter Foster writing in The Telegraph in November, the Paris attacks threaten the very essence of the European way of life as far-right parties seek to capitalize on the attacks, analysts have warned. And he questioned how much longer this vision of a tolerant and multicultural society can survive. And that brings us nicely to the second thing that's really causing this rise of fear of terrorism and of Islam. And that is this the immigration crisis. And that's been another huge change over the past year. So 2014, you had 280,000 migrants enter the EU. And back then, that was a big deal. That was driving a lot of headlines. That was driving a lot of EU summits and discussions. In 2015, we've already passed the 1 million mark. And we've not finished counting yet. So already four times more the number of migrants, mostly from the Middle East, mostly Muslim, coming in to Europe. And so, again, this is causing exactly the same kind of rise of fear of terrorism and fear of Islam. One quote I meant to read just earlier, you had the New York Times writing an article called "After Paris Attacks, a Darker Mood Towards Islam Emerges in France." And so with these two working together, you've got this perfect storm now of increasing fear of Islam. And Trumpet columnist Brad McDonald wrote about this for the print edition of The Trumpet, again, before the Paris attacks, about how just the immigration crisis was leading to this fear of Islam. And that was an article called Europe's Old Demons Return. And we've seen this really big outpouring of news coverage, especially from Germany, about this change in attitude and this very dramatic change in attitude. Here are some headlines that we included in our Trumpet Weekly magazine over the past few months. Germans stock up on weapons for self-defense. Fear, anger, and hatred. The rise of Germany's new right. Angela Merkel will survive, but will the soul of post-war Germany? How many Germans secretly admire Hitler? The German lynch mob, Islamophobe movement returns with a vengeance. And so these are largely articles from mainstream popular news outlets like Spiegel. You've got the Associated Press, very respectable, unemotional kind of news outlet, talking about a wave of fury, moving across Europe, writing about Germans being increasingly drawn into inflammatory rhetoric and at times anti-foreigner sentiment. Beyond the headlines, we've got cold hard statistics. We don't have the full statistics for 2015, but what we do have is dramatic. In 2014, there were 6 attacks on asylum hostels. By the beginning of December for 2015, it was 68. Police have recorded 817 criminal acts on asylum hostels so far. The German official said that in October, there were 1,700 crimes motivated by right-wing politics within Germany. And that was up from about 1,500 the year before. So we're seeing these big changes in Germany, and in some of his coverage on this, Mr. Flurry has pointed to an article in Spiegel called "What's Happening to My Country" by Michael Feldenkirchen. And he talked about how the mood in the country is akin to a drunken rage of the kind last seen in the beer halls of the 1920s Weimar Republic. And so these two trends, this terrorist attack, this Islamic migrant crisis, and really they work closely together to fuel this fear. And you've got people like one of the main organizers of the Paris attack boasting about how easily he could come and go between Europe and Syria. And so that is what is really pushing this dramatic change in attitude that will lead to major changes in the world ahead.
You know, the main prophecy that we talk about in terms of triggering important events in Europe and really globally is there in Daniel 11 about a Middle Eastern Islamist power pushing at Europe. And what you're talking about, this intensified fear of terrorism within Europe, this mistrust of Muslims that you see really hardening among Europeans, that fits this prophetic picture precisely, doesn't it?
It does. And there's no sign that this push is going to get any less. In fact, just about all the analysts will say, you know, it's only a matter of time before we have more terrorist attacks in Europe.
Right.
They say that if anything, the immigration crisis in 2016 is going to be bigger than 2015. So we're just seeing a small precursor of what will be an even more dramatic push to come.
Yeah, that's really remarkable. When you're talking about the factors that have fueled this kind of response within Europe, it's really just the beginning. I mean, the two terrorist attacks that you mentioned, we're still talking about, you know, in the dozens of victims. We're still talking about, you know, fewer than 200 people total. And given the fact that the the Muslim crisis or the refugee crisis is intensifying, that the determination among some of these individuals to inflict terror, the determination among Islamists, whether they be Islamic State or homegrown, wherever they're from, that's only increasing. So you could just, you could see this. I mean, you really have a pretty good picture of what we could easily see happen in 2016.
Absolutely.
Well, even this morning we saw headlines out of Belgium, authorities arresting suspects who were on the verge of conducting terrorist attacks. So this isn't something that is going away. And now, like you said, we have an additional million people in Europe that are very incompatible with European culture, European values in many ways. George Friedman wrote an article for Stratfor before he left, talking about how the Muslim immigrants in Europe have been welcomed. They've been brought into nations like Germany, but they've never become German. And that's an important point to remember when we're talking about this conflict between cultures, this clash of civilizations that Bible prophecy tells us is coming. And we see that in Europe much more stark today than we did a year ago. That's not even talking about the other side. Mr. Fleury has pointed to radical Islam being part of the push. The other part of the push he's mentioned in the past is oil and energy politics. And I know Brent was talking a little bit about that earlier, but we're seeing some of those very same things impacting Europe as well. Where does Europe get its energy supplies from? It's relying on Russia. It's relying on the Middle East. And the Middle East is in turmoil. And the Middle East is, you know, this is where this tension with Europe is brewing currently between those two powers.
And you, going back to, you mentioned Friedman's analysis of the situation, and he's written a few articles over the past year, and especially in his book, which he brought out at the beginning of 2015, about, you know, as this problem keeps getting worse, as you have more and more Muslims, some of which are committing terrorist attacks, how do you deal with the problem? And the point that he made is eventually you get to the point where you either stick with your kind of tolerant liberal values and just accept there's going to be a certain rate of terrorist attacks, a certain rate of people dying, and we're just going to have to live with that. Or you start stigmatizing all Muslims, because there's no easy way for those in authority to tell the difference between a Muslim who will commit a terrorist attack and they won't. And he said, he talked about how that sounds completely alien to us now, but this is going to, as these attacks keep happening, it's going to push Europe in the direction of stigmatizing all Muslims. And that means dropping the kind of tolerant, liberal, multicultural Europe we have right now. And when you look at how Europe has been when it's not been tolerant, liberal, and multicultural, that's something of huge danger to people way beyond Muslims. I mean, when they've been that way, they've threatened the whole of the known world.
Right. We're already seeing Europeans take steps because of this fear, because of this mistrust. We're seeing them start to do things that we would not have seen a year ago, that we would not have seen 5 years ago. They're taking a more aggressive approach, you know, militarily extending themselves, the way that they're treating Muslims, the kind of, you mentioned the attacks on asylum against those refugees within Germany and so on. These things wouldn't have happened a year ago.
No, and I think there's a growing sense this year among knowledgeable commentators who have been paying attention. There's this growing sense of there's something very disturbing happening in Germany. Because we've been talking about at the Trumpet what's prophesied for Germany, the rise of a strong and assertive Germany. And to a lot of people, that's looked completely ridiculous. Because if you just take a surface look at Germany, that's not what Germany is today. But with the news that's come out this year, for the first time ever, I think there's been this sense from people watching Germany of, oh, well, actually, this much darker Germany is a very real possibility. And I've never gotten that sense, really, reading non-Trumpet commentators before.
And Richard, as you've written about in the past, Germany is not just trying to stop the flow of Muslims just from getting into their borders. They are trying to go to the source of those problems. They are expanding beyond the borders of Europe. They are going into Afghanistan. They are going into North Africa, as you've written before. You wrote about the Ring of Fire. Specifically, I'll just comment just a little bit about Mali, because in Mali, if you might remember, in 2012, Al Qaeda pretty much took the northern part of Mali, and that's a chunk of territory that's as big as France, and they took control of that country. And what often happens in those cases is that those territories become breeding grounds for terrorism to be exported back to Europe. So in that kind of a development, Europe was more worried than anyone else, and they did do something about it. France led the intervention in Mali, and this year, following a November attack in Mali, the Germans also promised to add more troops to the Mali contingency there, and France plans to withdraw when German troops get into Mali. So you're seeing Germany expanding beyond its borders, trying to stem this problem right at the source of it.
So I think it's important to add that this isn't a robust... What we're not seeing is Germany getting to the cause of the problem right now. We're at the very beginning of that effort. I think the German military is constrained... It's still developing that capacity. They don't want to rush too fast at the moment. They've only just really had the public opinion behind them to start expanding their military involvement in the world.
But at the same time, Richard, these are unprecedented actions from Germany's perspective, from the people in Germany. This is not everyday business for them. This is something that is new, and it's unique in that sense.
Right, absolutely. That is. Yeah, I don't want to take away from that at all. But this isn't Angela Merkel solving the problem of immigration, of the migration crisis of North Africa, of Syria, by sending 1,000 troops to Mali and having this mandate for Syria. They are big steps for Germany, but they're not solving the problem either. And it's important to recognize that they're making these big steps, but this is only on the way to Germany really cracking down and getting to the source of the problem. They're moving in that direction, but they're not there quite yet.
You know, it's interesting too, just talking about this this overarching trend of this intensification of sentiment against Muslims and this fear of terrorism, how that's influencing another major development that we're seeing within Europe, and that is Germany's dominance, its economic and political dominance of Europe. That really took a lurch forward in 2015. You know, earlier this year, we were seeing protests in Greece against German power. You know, we had this recent backlash in the Spanish elections against German power. But you just have to wonder, how much are those concerns going to be swallowed up by the larger concerns that are facing Europe? How much are those, the concerns that we're talking about with respect to Islamism and terrorism, going to mitigate against that sort of a backlash against German power, where you're actually going to have more people saying, you know what, we need a stronger Germany in order to deal with these threats?
Absolutely. I mean, you see in times of war, usually everybody forgets about civil liberties and all these kind of things are not really a concern when your life is at danger. And quite rightly so in most cases. You know, Churchill, Lincoln all cracked down on things like habeas corpus. So these ideas of like national sovereignty, they're rather academic and they become irrelevant when you're worried that your family is under threat. So you've got that. And then you can also see this happening already, especially with Poland, and you had some quotes from Polish leaders talking about how, faced with a resurgent Russia, they were saying things like, well, Europe no longer fears a strong Germany. They fear when Germany is not strong enough. And Poland felt this threat from Russia in a way that Greece and that Italy and these other nations didn't feel under threat at that time. And so they're willing to take these steps to give up some of their sovereignty, to integrate parts of their army with Germany and look at drawing close to Germany. So we see this happening in practice with those nations that feel the most threatened. And as they become more threatened, we'll see this more. And as new nations and as Southern Europe and the rest of Europe feels more threatened by terrorism, you're absolutely right. They'll become less reticent to cede power to a central authority and ultimately to Germany.
You know, Richard, maybe you could just talk for a minute or two about how much Germany has cemented its grip on power within Europe over the past year?
Well, even before, or even just as the year was getting started, Spiegel had an article called The Fourth Reich, What Some Europeans See When They Look at Germany. This was in the spring, and they concluded that an empire is in play, at least in the economic realm. The Eurozone is clearly ruled by Germany, though Berlin is not unchallenged. So you had this big German dominance even at the start of this year. Then the major event in this dominance was you had Greece attempt to rebel against the austerity imposed largely by Germany. They elected a left-wing government at the start of the year that promised to reject austerity. They fought against it. They even put the terms that were kind of being imposed upon them to a referendum. The Greeks rejected those terms in a referendum. And the very next day, Germany forced the Greek government to capitulate and to accept those terms. And so now you've got European Union officials with veto power over Greek laws. And basically, German officials and European Union officials going in there and dictating Greek taxing and spending policy. So Germany really made an example of Greece. And this went way beyond Greece, though, because this example resonated across the Eurozone. And the Financial Times at the time wrote, this was the real coup over the weekend, not only a regime change in Greece, but also regime change in the Eurozone. And so you mentioned earlier things like the Spanish election and this backlash from Spain and Portugal and these other nations against Germany. Already that backlash would have been tons worse by now if it weren't for what happened in Greece. All of these new political parties, they're treading much more carefully. They're not talking, they're talking less and less about a kind of open rebellion against austerity. They're saying that actually they'll stick with the different bailout terms, etc., because they saw what happened to Greece. And so because of that example that was made of them over the summer, they're much more reluctant to challenge Germany. And then just look at how every crisis that has come along, it's really been clear that who has been in charge. I mean, look at how Europe's still dealing with Russia. It was Germany that just completely dictated whether the sanctions for Russia got extended for another 6 months. Other nations had different ideas. Didn't matter. Germany got its way. Even Germany's way of dealing with the migrant crisis, that's caused a lot of resentment across Europe, but Germany's got its way. Germany has set the tone of Europe's policy for dealing with immigrants. So we saw Germany extend its dominance over the Eurozone, and we saw more and more examples of German dominance over the Eurozone too.
You know, I think anyone familiar with Herbert W. Armstrong and his prophecies about Germany and about Europe has to be moved to see these kinds of headlines. If they're paying attention, in the February Trumpet issue, this is the February 2016 Trumpet issue that we have coming out shortly, Stephen Fleury has an article called Herbert W. Armstrong's Signature Prophecy. And watching this unfold, it really is a dramatic fulfillment of what Herbert W. Armstrong said was going to happen there in Germany. So just to conclude the segment, Richard, the biggest change you think we should watch for in the coming year in Europe?
Actually, you set me up with a nice segue there. The very first headline, I believe it was, or at least one of the very first that Mr. Armstrong ever printed on when he started looking at producing a magazine was, is a world dictator about to appear, pointing to a strong leader in Europe. Now, all of this fear of Islam and this fear of terrorism is creating big political unrest in Europe. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty, especially in Germany. So the big thing that we're looking for now is political turmoil. And that's also going to be driven by the euro and the euro crisis. And ultimately, all of this political turmoil is going to lead for people wanting more and more, not just a strong Germany, but a strong leader ruling Germany and ruling the whole Eurozone. So that is the direction Europe is traveling in. That's what we need to watch out for over the next year.
All right. Thank you, Richard. Richard is putting these thoughts together in an article, How the World Changed in 2015 in Europe. You can look for that on thetrumpet.com. We'll have a short break, and then we will finish today's program with a look at some of the changes in this work in 2015. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We're going to conclude the show today with a brief look at how this work has changed in 2015. I have our social media manager, David Vigil, with us to give us some year-end insights. Today, we're just going to focus on the radio station. Hello, David.
Hi, it's great to be back after a long hiatus there.
So a year ago, this radio station didn't even exist. So the major change is that KPCG was born. Why don't you give us a picture of what we've accomplished this past year?
Sure. So we have now 4 shows, not counting The Key of David, which is the TV series made into an audio format. So 4 shows. That's The Trumpet Hour, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Live by Every Word, and Music for Life. So put all those shows together, and there have been 255 episodes aired on KPCG.fm.
When did we start again?
I believe we started the end of May.
Okay, so basically 6-7 months, 255 episodes. That's a lot of programming.
Especially when you think of the minutes, that comes out to a total of 12,296 minutes of audio material.
Wow.
All brand new.
So can you give us a sense of what kind of reach we have with this with these programs?
Yes. So online radio is a little notorious for not giving out full stats like you would have, say, with websites. But we do have some stats involving our live radio feed and also some subscribers in various platforms that we can get the information from. So, for instance, when people tune in on KPCG.fm or thetrumpet.com to listen to a show live, we can kind of look at the hour it aired on originally and see how many people tuned in. And for that, we have, on average for the Trumpet Hour, about 159 people doing that. I think it's pretty awesome to have people tune in every Wednesday and Friday for this. For the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, for those who are interested in following that show as well, the average people who tune in live for that one every morning is 316. That's the number of people. So that, I think that's pretty accurate as far as what we can see there.
And then as far as pulling the stream down and listening to it at other times.
So on demand, our stats are divided into basically the SoundCloud, where we put our programs on, make it easily shareable, and track it easier. So we embed that in thetrumpet.com. For the Trumpet Hour, there's 245 followers, and they, on average, each program on average receives about 991 plays. So that's pretty awesome there. And then we have stats based on the RSS feed, which feeds into different podcast apps, whether it's on your iPhone or places like Stitcher or TuneIn there. And Trumpet Hour there has 376 subscribers. So the numbers are pretty close to the same with the Trumpet Daily. Trumpet Daily has just a few more subscribers there. And, you know, it's pretty remarkable when you think about it. When you compare the numbers of radio programs on average with our Trumpet.com articles on average, we have about the same reach there. So that's what was able to be accomplished there in the last 6 or 7 months.
Is it growing?
It is growing. We are expecting to see growth next year. Because we didn't do anything last year, we don't have any year-over-year data, but it is still growing.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time, David. And we'll have you back next week to give us some more statistics about thetrumpet.com, right?
Yes.
All right. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories that we talked about on the program today, and also where you can go to get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Anthony Chibadewe, Richard Palmer, and David Vigil.
You're very welcome.
Honored to be here.
Great to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Louis L'Amour. There will be a time when you believe everything is finished. That will be the beginning. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.